boot camps need to be shot. And people should quit going to college.
In my branches, like, I own reality.
I don't think school should teach you GIT.
Welcome back, Prime.
Hey, thank you.
We just finished writing your GIT course. I should say you just finished writing your GIT course, and I just finished helping edit it and ship a bunch of command line tooling so that it's interactive.
Facts.
Let's talk about that. Why do you care about Git? Why did you want to teach Git in the first place?
Git is the kind of like the foundational. It's like the very bottom of the things you should probably know and be good at, because, you know, I'm sure most people have some story. If you've met anyone that's old enough, they have a story where they used to manage everything via FTP. And there's that one time where they accidentally uploaded the wrong file and erased all their work. And, you know, like, if you've just been around long enough, we all have had this exact same story. And it's like very disheartening when it does happen, but it does happen. And so, you know, having a good understanding of Git just makes life a lot easier. Because, you know, I remember every single thing that was kind of magical when I was younger as a developer always was something along the lines of, okay, hey, ooh, I used XArgs. I have no idea what that is. Oh, hey, I used grep. I have no idea what that is. Sed, it's no idea what that is. Oh, you know, you just got to type in some commands with Git. Okay, I can understand Git, add, commit, and push and pull. You know, and like, that's it. And then I never really went deeper because it always was just like, wow, that's such a like daunting thing to learn. But at some point in your career, you realize that nothing's really daunting. It's all actually pretty simple. And if you just take a little bit of time, it can massively improve your life. Here's a good example. For 10 years, whenever I'd rebase and there'd be a conflict, I would edit the conflict. And then instead of doing rebase continue, I would do git commit like a dummy, because it's just like, you know, it's just like so ingrained in my head. Like, I got changes, git commit, make the commit, and boom. Now I've committed. I actually didn't know how to undo that. Like, for a long time, I had no idea what to do. So what did I do? I would just actually git rebase abort, redo it, re-resolve the conflict, and then, ooh, careful. Like, sometimes I did it twice in a row, and I was just like so frustrated with myself. But I did that for like a decade, not realizing that I could git reset soft and pull, like, walk back that change, re-put it in, and then just rebase continue. And so it's just like these little things that you learn that are just like so useful with just knowing Git that will just save you these little teeny tiny pieces of pain some point along the way. And that's not rebase specific either. You can get a revert can also get a conflict. A cherry pick can also get a conflict, and you can run into the same situation. Merges are the only one where the conflict's resolution is committing, so that, you know, you don't have to know that little trick there. But it's just like those things are just so important. They save your bacon every single time.
Well, let me ask you this question. Did you learn Git in school? You got a CS degree. It's been over a decade now, right?
Yeah. Git was invented the year I went to school.
Okay, so no Git in school.
There's no Git in school. Yeah. Academia moves entirely too slow to have something like Git. I on my own, started using Tortoise SVN to manage my own projects because I wanted the way to like be Mr., you know, super, super businessy. And the only reason why I knew about Tortoise, if I'm not mistaken, was the fact that in 2008, I had an internship at a place called Computers Unlimited, to which community member Bisco may have heard of Bisco. He also worked at the same place. And so, there is where I discovered Tortoise. And from there, I started making all my stuff with Tortoise.
Is that Tortoise?
Yeah, it's Tortoise SVN. Tortoise.
So I had a similar experience. So I went to school a little bit later, but Git was out, but I didn't learn Git at all because academia does tend to move pretty slow. I got a job while I was a senior at university, and I just heard online, someone was like, oh, like, if you're going into a job and you don't know Git, like, that's going to be really embarrassing. So I like learned Git like after I got the job, but before I started the job in like 3 days. I say learned Git. I didn't learn Git, but like I learned what it was. I did some stuff so that when I showed up at the job, it wouldn't be completely embarrassing.
It's not that hard either, right? Like when you learned it, it was probably pretty straightforward. Like, you know, there's a little bit of confusion, but it's not a crazy piece of technology. I mean, what it does is crazy, but using it's pretty uncrazy.
No, I got like the crash course, which was just, okay, make all your changes, keep a clean git ignore, and then from the top level of your repo, run git add dot, git commit, git push. Like,
you know, that's not that far away from real production reality, right? Yeah, I mean, I at this point, it's still to this day, I just git add dot.
Okay, so when my workflow is that I keep a very clean git ignore, and then I always git add dot, usually from the top level of the repo, unless I know that all my changes are like downstream from wherever I happen to be at. A lot of people don't like that. A lot of people like adding files individually. What do you do?
I do git add dot from the top. I think people that are upset about that, I don't quite understand it. Like you know, when you delete a directory, do you delete them one file at a time? It's like if you take care of all your stuff and you have, if everything you want to add is everything that has changed, why would you add them one by one? Like, it doesn't make any sense, right? And so yeah. I'm pretty judicious on not adding things. That's why I always make sure, I always like test with out. So that's like my file. Like, I'll always pipe all my stuff to out. And in Vim with Fugitive, if I do GI on a changed file, it'll open up a dot git excludes. And so I'll add it to my internal excludes, not the actual git ignore. Hmm. And so that way I exclude it from ever being added, and it doesn't ever show up in the git ignore and all that. So it's like personal files that I always ignore. So I always make sure I have a very clean git exclude and a clean git ignore. And then I always make sure that, you know, I just don't create any other temporary files like that. And so whenever I git add, it's always just my changes.
Yeah. My first step whenever I'm working with temporary files is to go add it to the git ignore, because I work very fast and very sloppily, like, just to be frank about it. And if I don't,
I do too.
Yeah. And if I don't put it in the git ignore, I'm going to accidentally commit it at some point.
I have a general rule of thumb that you will never get it right first try. So I don't even try, right? Like, if you've been watching any of the stream, I just got done building multiplayer Minesweeper, where we had all Twitch play Minesweeper. But I built all of that, got it all done. And now that I got done doing it, and now that I've started the Doom side, I realize, oh, there's all these things I want to change. So it's like, did I really ever get it right? No, it just gave me the ability to know what I didn't know. So now I have like virtually no unknown unknowns. I now can actually formulate it in my head and build it right the second try.
Right.
So I'm on that team. Just like I'd rather work fast and sloppy and clean up later than work perfect and slow and then realize all my perfection was wrong anyways, because I just had unknown unknowns.
Yeah, I rely on my tools to rein in the sloppiness. Like, because yeah. Like, I go fast and sloppy, and then I really hope that my tools like keep me in check, which is why I really struggle with dynamic programming languages, among like other things. Anything that doesn't keep me on the rails tends to be harder for me. Slows me down.
Fair and interesting. Okay, can I go back for a quick second? You did say that, you know, we were talking about getting taught Git in school. I'm going to make a really, 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 really smoldering hot take. And I'll even tweet it at the same time if we need to, which is that I don't think schools should teach you Git.
Tell me why. This is the hottest take.
I think schools, if they were going to teach you that, I think you should have a part of a semester on how to implement version control.
You think one of two extremes, either they shouldn't teach it at all, or they should teach it, but they should teach how to implement it, how to build Git.
Correct. Well, I mean, just take any other class in the world at school. Data structures. They don't teach you about using data structures. They teach you how to implement it and then explain why it's this way. Let's go with compilers. You learn how to build a compiler. You don't talk about compilers. You go to networks. You don't talk about networks. You build like protocols. Right, like everything about academia is to teach you the foundation of it. So if we're going to talk about version control, let's talk about version control and how version control works, different types of version control. And then maybe there's like a day where it's like, also there's Git. You should check out Git, and let's talk about why, like how its algorithms work. Like, to me, that would be the proper, if we're going high level foundational approach, that would be the proper way to do it. Just teaching someone Git, like what's the class does that fall into? You know, to me, CS101 is just like, hey, we have a GitHub, push all your stuff up to GitHub. Good luck. Right? Like that, to me, that would be the school teaches you Git is by forcing you to use Git with your other schoolmates.
Right. In my last semester, I was forced to use Git, and there was no instruction. It was just like, we're using GitHub Classroom. Good luck. Which is fine.
Git push, Git pull, Git add, and Git commit. Like, they're not hard. You will figure that out pretty quickly. It's all the other stuff that really, like, you never investigate beyond. You don't realize how powerful Git is. You never really understand how Git stores stuff. So therefore, like, a lot of things don't make any sense. And then once you realize that it's all just Git is every single commit contains the entire tree, all of a sudden things start making more sense. You can kind of guess how these things work. It's better. That's why we do that right away in the course, by the way. I go straight for like the heart of how things are stored, because then everything else just feels like it makes more sense.
Yeah, it's like chapter 3 is labeled internals. You go straight to the plumbing command.
You go straight to the plumbing, and then the porcelain becomes much more interesting once you understand how the plumbing works. And then you realize like, oh, okay, so when I read the word index or staging area, I know what we're talking about. When we're talking about work tree, I know what I'm talking about. Then work trees makes more sense. Once you understand work tree, you understand work trees, and then That's part two. We'll have work trees and all that, but
yeah,
you get the idea.
And by the way, quick plug, boot.dev, use code Prime, 25% off your payment.
Boot.dev/Prime. boot.dev/Prime. Please don't pay Lane. Pay me. Pay me, not Lane.
You got to actually use the code. use the code. Cool. So I want to derail us selfishly for like 10 minutes to talk about what you just said, because I actually do have a lot of thoughts on this. It's less about Git specifically, but more about this general idea of like, what should you learn in school in the first place? Because I think a lot of us go to university with like, I would call it like bifurcated expectations. And what I mean by that is like, on the one hand, you've got academia, which really can be looked at as like you're learning foundational knowledge about subject matter. And the people that are more advanced in that field are like pushing the boundaries, or at least attempting to push the boundaries of like human knowledge, right? Like when you really get up into a field, you're trying to discover new things, right?
Yeah, that's fair to say.
And on the other hand, we're expecting it to be a career training program. and those two things, like, they're fundamentally not the same. And I wouldn't even just say it's like our expectations of school. Like, schools are advertising themselves, marketing themselves, talking about themselves in both of those ways as well. And I think it's led to some weird stuff where people graduate with degrees thinking that the degrees meant I'm ready for XYZ job. But like, job market's changing every year. What you learned in your degree doesn't always map up. What do you think about this? How should we think about school in 2024?
So I think it's good to know first where school came from, because I think that kind of, again, like the Git internals, learning where things kind of come from, I think helps a lot. So originally, whenever you went to higher education, education beyond like, you know, just your basic learning how to read back in the day, you would go to, and you'd go and get your bachelor's. And a lot of times this was reserved only for the wealthy class, because the point of going was to get a well-rounded education in math, reading, history, and then like the various arts. And you would do that, and that would be your bachelor. So like a liberal arts degree today was considered like the de facto standard. And the point of it was for you to be able to leisure well as you are, you know, as you are walking upon your great estates back in the day, you would then ponder how Dante described Ring 5 of Hell, right? Like, it was meant to be a place to like really greatly think about
so you history, could speak intelligently
philosophy.
At parties.
yeah. You'd have, I mean, that's why, like, go read the dinner parties of Wordsworth and Coleridge and Keats and all these the great poets of England. And it's wild, the differences. The difference was, at the dinner party, these great poets would get up and they would recite their poetry and people would listen and be into it, right? Like, the world was vastly different than it is today. So that's like, you got to have that as like, this is where this thing comes from. The problem is today, we're all about like productivity and output. So our expectation is we go here to become better, right? We're going there to become subject matter experts on something. And you really don't go there to go become a subject matter expert for a bachelor's. That's like a PhD. That's when you become the actual subject matter expert. But a PhD, you go there, like, it's preparing the foundation for you to become a subject matter expert. And so that's like fundamentally misaligned with workforce. Workforce, you do not have to be a subject matter expert. That usually comes as you get a little bit, you know, as you get further into your career, you'll start finding that as you write more libraries and things, you start running into more of these subject matter expert issues. So with all that in mind, it's not surprising that we have this expectation that school should fix things, because, you know, I think our parents, a lot of people didn't get to go to school. And each generation, more and more people had the ability or access to school. Like, my great grandfather went to college. He's one of, like, I don't know, a handful of people on the western side of the United States that were able to go to college, right? It's like a very small, and he went there for handwriting was one of his classes. Like, handwriting. It's wild, right? He had handwriting and reading as two of his foundational courses for graduating with a bachelor's. And so it's like we've greatly changed. And there's one more thing that I forgot to say. During the time of Coleridge and Wordsworth, so the mid-1700s, there's this concept of a man who knows everything. Coleridge was arguably the last man who knew everything. And what that meant is that you could go to college and you could become a subject matter in every single field at one point. And so that's ended. That ended a long time ago. You can no longer do that. You know, for you to become a subject matter expert, now you just one super niche field, like networks, for 20 years.
Right.
Now you are the expert at just networks, not even neural nets, just networks, right? It's already just like so thin that it's like, it's vastly different. And so you put all those things together, like college was meant for leisure. You at one point could know everything. You put all these things together and it's like, You go there, they set you all up, but it's all just getting yourself ready to even becoming an expert. And then we're saying, hey, you're ready for the real world, but hey, the real world, you got to make money, you got to make this, you got that, you know, the hustle of the real life, all that. You put it all together and it just sucks. And so here's my super hot take after saying all those words, which is that I think what truly needs to happen is boot camps need to be shot and people should quit going to college. And we need a 2 to 4 year trade school. A trade school that's really focused. It's like a boot camp, but longer, but actually gives people like data structures, get version control, like implementing these harder things. That's like talk, like we will not only do you implement some things about network, you actually implement some of the fundamental things. So you just like get it. Like it's like quickly and ferociously preparing you for a real job. And so to me, like a 2 to 4 year type of window is really how long it takes to become actually useful. And I think that's why college has persisted for so long, is because after the first year, the kids that remain in get kind of bit by computer science, and then they're off. They're just building things. They're doing stuff. So they come out of college almost as if they've had a 4 year trade school because they've been just doing stuff with all their friends. And so they're largely applicable comparatively to someone that, say, comes out of a boot camp, because boot camps are like really great at just JavaScript, but they don't, you know, everything else is missing. So if you're like, hey, we need you to resolve this, they'd be like, right, I don't even know what that is, let alone what even it touches, you know? And so I think that's kind of where all these things come. And I really do hope we get to the point of trade, like trades-ish school. That's why I like boot.dev. In my head, it's like, it's starting to try to form this role of education is not 6 months long and then you're ready for the work place. It's also shouldn't be 4 years of just learning foundation material. There's something in the middle that's like super useful. I know that was like the most long-winded answer. Sorry for that, but it's just like, that's how I think. Why did we get here?
Yeah, I agree.
It's unfortunate.
Trade school is a good way to put it, because the word boot camp, the reason I named it boot dev was to be tongue in cheek. Like, I was really frustrated with boot camps, specifically like your Node.js full stack boot camps, where the marketing, it's really it's a lack of content, but also the marketing around like, this only takes 3 months. Like, it doesn't take 3 months. Like, for you to be useful in a job, it takes longer than 3 months.
I can barely learn the syntax and be like proficient in a language at my skill level in 3 months. I'd say I'm moderately sufficient in Go. And I've been programming for 20 years practically. And in 3 months, I got pretty good at Go, but I wouldn't even call myself that great. Like, I wouldn't be like, if it was hiring me purely on my Go skills, I would be like maybe like a junior to maybe getting near a mid-level engineer at Go. And so like, that's absolutely absurd to think that someone who's never even touched code could even think within 1 year you would be like super, super ultra like there.
I bet you're more in between the mid to senior. Like, you may not have like the standard library memorized yet, but Go is a really small language. You probably know more of it than you even think.
But there's like so many dangers that I keep learning. Like, just yesterday I learned that if you have a struct that has a pointer to another struct, you can call functions on it even though it's nil. Right. Like those, like all the little, the 100 Go mistakes now, like that book now actually seems really, really exciting to read. At first, when I was reading it, I just didn't have like the traction to really understand it. Now that I've used Go enough, now I have the traction to really get it.
90 of the 100, I think, are nil pointer dereferences.
It's unfortunate. Again, where Zig is really awesome. I know you talked about wanting, you're excited about Zig. Zig, it has the nullable notation. So it's not like an option like Rust, but it's more like a C# nullable or a TypeScript nullable. You can say, hey, this thing could be null, and you just kind of put that on there.
Are you forced by the compiler then to do the check?
You have that kind of like typing.
Check it at compile time, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You have to do some checking. I believe you have to go if thing capture group thing, and then you can use it.
So you're still runtime checking, but you're forced to runtime check.
So you can't. Effectively, you're still runtime checking. Yes, I mean you still do the same runtime checks with Rust or an option, because the options you still have to go like match, and match does a byte lookup or a I think it's a 60, technically it's like the width of your system lookup like table on the type of enum it is, but it does like an int compare lookup. I'd assume that a null check is an int compare at the end of the day. And it's even the fastest one does not equal zero.
My rule is just anytime I see a nil pointer different reference in Go, anytime, the if statement better be like the line before it. And sometimes I'll review a PR and they're like, I checked like 40 lines before, so it's guaranteed. I'm like, I don't care. Like, I really want that check to be right before it, or I'm going to forget, or someone's going to remove that check or whatever.
Yeah. The locality of behavior. It's a real thing, right? If you can put those expectations as close as possible together, it almost exclusively is really, really nice.
Okay. So we've got the Git course. It is out now. Anyone that wants to go check it out. We go into internals. This is just part one. So you might take the course. It's, I believe, 10 chapters long, about 50 or so lessons. You might be like, wow, that was like Git Basics. It is Git Basics. We're doing a part two. Part two is going to go even more into, I think the things we still have to do are like some conflict resolution stuff, some more plumbing,
a bunch of merge and rebase stuff. All the conflict side of things, cherry picking, all the rebase side of things, squashing, editing history.
We did touch on rebasing. We just didn't do conflicts with rebasing yet.
Yeah. We didn't. I did no conflicts during the first part because conflicts, you know, they don't usually happen that frequent. And so it's good to know what to do. But I figured that you'd want all the other stuff. Like if you could only take a small thing, it's better to have the stuff that gives you all the power first. And then you can look up how to do conflicts. Or part two, we'll just have everything about conflicts, and then we'll get into like cherry pick, revert, all the other things, work trees, tags. Tags are really simple. They just appear later on. Tags are
the way I think
simple.
About how so. We've split up part one and part two. Again, if you're interested in the course, is part one's really like everything you need to know to be competent as a solo developer working with Git. Again, why we don't really deal with conflicts, because as a solo developer, you rarely conflict with yourself. It's kind of weird. So part two should cover more of like working with a team and things like that.
I would say that if you get done with part one and you're willing to look up how to resolve a conflict or just use VS Code or IntelliJ or Fugitive, then part one is enough for you to work in a big organization as well. It gives you pretty much all the things you'll need, other than you'll find yourself doing something every now and then that's slightly inefficient that takes two or three commands, but that's just due to you not like the whole Git rebase, abort, Git rebase, do it again. I just didn't know about Git reset soft.
head tilde one. That's the weirdest syntax. Especially when you're new to Git. Like it makes sense once you understand how the commit tree works and everything. It's fucking weird. Head all caps and then a tilde and then one.
Yeah, that's true.
It threw me off.
I guess like one thing I don't even know is if the commit before you was a merge commit, meaning it took the merge base and then took the two different distinct trees, put them together and then put it together. What does head tilde two mean? I don't even I don't even know the answer to that because
are they ordered?
My guess is that it's probably the branch that was merged on is the branch that you walk back on. That's my guess, but honestly, I have no idea. Or not head tilde one, sorry, branch tilde one, or whatever the line was. Head tilde one should just be your previous places your head was, but branch tilde one. If you walk back X commits, where does it go on a merge commit? I don't know. I just assume it goes to the branch that it was merged on, not the incoming branch, but the source branch or the target branch, not the source branch.
I don't know the answer, but that sounds reasonable. Linus must have decided.
Like those little things, I still don't even know the answer because he made it in 5 days and figured that out, and that's that.
Okay, I have a couple more questions about Git. Famous argument, right? Rebase versus merge, right?
Rebase.
I was a merge Andy for a long time. Just in the last couple of years, I've started using rebase a lot more, and I've kind of landed on this workflow where I always rebase my feature branches off of main. I never rebase the main trunk. How has your relationship with merge and rebase evolved over the years, and what is your current workflow?
Yeah, so start the oldie days. I just merged. I didn't know what rebase was. Sounds scary. So there's that. And then once I learned what rebase was, I just used it almost exclusively. So obviously the thing is, you never change the history of a public branch. So your main line, whatever that is, you wouldn't want to change history, because if you change history, you like just destroy your history's diverged from everybody else, and you can just ruin stuff. So don't do that. That's obvious. Easy win. Don't do that. As far as your branches are concerned, there is some minor inconveniences with rebase, which is like if say you push up to your like the team repo and then you realize you need to make a change or you want to bring in some new master changes and you want to like put it on top. Well, then you have to force push up your branch to that repo. Again, not a problem because it's like it's your branch. People typically aren't playing around with your branch. It's just the main one you don't want to touch. And so I have no problems with that. People are like, oh, but you have to force push. I'm like, I don't care. I'm force pushing on my own thing with nobody else looking. Like too pedantic for me to really care. And so as far as it goes with merge and rebase, I would say the naive approach is you always merge. And there's a good reason why you should not do that approach. I think this also just comes with modern JavaScript philosophy and modern website design philosophy, why merge is kind of making this kind of a renaissance kind of thing happening right now. and why people are saying rebase is so evil is one, huge misunderstanding. Two, they don't know their tools. And three, just modern whatever philosophy. There you go. There's that. So let's go over each one. So modern philosophy a lot is push forward at all times. If something breaks in your site, push forward. They didn't live in this world of you have a product in which you only get one single opportunity to ship something. So you put it into QA when it doesn't work. It's just like, bam, you're back out. You have to refigure out how to get it in. Instead, we're moving so quick. People are just building on top of everything. Everything's super evergreen, not large, you know, legacy maintenance systems. So revert is just like not something people think about. So no one reverts a commit anymore. They kind of just try to push forward through a bug. But every now and then you do have a commit that is like, this bug is revertible. You need to revert it. There's just not a push forward right now. We're going to have to really think about this. And if you use merge as opposed to rebase, reverting could become excessively difficult. And what I mean by that, here, I think I could make this work even with this kind of thinned view. And I think it'll make more sense if I just kind of draw this more than anything else. I think I talk about this in the course, but I'm actually not sure if I give the best like reason why I do this. There we go. So let's just pretend you have two lines. We have our main line, which is going this way. And then you have your feature line going this way, right? And you guys branched off right here, somewhere in here. So this is the main line going right here. This is the main line right here. And this is your feature. If you were to say, get main's changes over, you'd create something called a merge commit, right? It would take this thing, the merge base, replay these changes, bada bing, you have this commit and you get all of your changes right here. And that's why if you do git log, you'll see that it has two parents as opposed to everything else having one parent. So pretty simple how merge works. But there's a problem here. Let's say we keep on going and now we want to go back. Well, if we go back, we create another merge commit. Okay, let's just say these X features, well, dang, they're actually, we need to pull these out. How do you pull these out? It becomes really bad. Or if you kind of invert the view and pretend this is the main line, right? And you're kind of going back and forth making these merge commits. How do you pull this out in a single command? You can't. It's like it becomes really, really difficult. And so if you were instead to rebase, so here I'll just redraw this thing one more time. And this is where the merge commit theoretically would have been. So if I would have theoretically just rebased, I would have been able to take this line and instead... Oops, there we go. I realized I did that wrong. I would have been able to, instead of branching from right here, I would have just simply moved the branching up to right here. And so it's like, okay, this is good. And then when they made another commit, I just did it again. Now we did this. And then I could have squashed this into one commit and then merged that back in here. And so now I have this nice no merge commit single thing. And then we find out this is bad. Well, then it's really easy just to take this and just undo it. Do a revert commit, which will actually create a new commit that's like the antimatter of this commit. And just take it out with a commit. And now you have this nice commit here, undoes what you did, everything's nice. And so this is like the philosophy, I think, of really good, long-running, more legacy-styled projects where you have to keep on building. Eventually, you get into this part where reverts could be an important facet to workflow. You may not have the time, the resources just to push forward, and you need to fix something that broke in production. Ideally, you can use feature flags and all these other strategies to never even find yourself in this position. But again, reality of development is you find yourself in the position you don't want to be in all the time. And so I always program with the one fundamental philosophy, which is always bet against yourself. And so when I program, I believe I'm going to screw it up. So that is why I write unit tests. It's why I rebase and move everything forward and move it into one commit and put it in, because there might come that day you have to revert. When I was at Netflix, I did it three times. That's it. 10 years, I did it three times. All three times, I had them as one nice little commit, popped it out, no merge commit, everything was beautiful. You know, imagine if I would have went back and forth like 15 times, like the disaster that would have been trying to clean up and trying to get my commit out of there when it's spread over four separate commits with three merge commits in betwixt.
I think I've only reverted the main line that like I had other teammates on definitely once that I can remember. Maybe twice, but I don't think I even got three.
It's a rarity. Generally, it's a rarity, but it does happen. Like, it's not an impossibility. It's just a rarity. And so that's like my philosophy in a nutshell. And so I think a big thing that people really struggle with is not knowing the tools. And so here's the tool that I think most people just don't realize exists. So let's pretend you have this. You have a branch and they've diverged. And here's your main line right here. and here's the feature line you're bringing in. So you rebase this. And so now it's now being rebased off of here. But while you did that, you got a conflict. You resolved your conflict. Everything is good. Now you can happily move forward with, again, it's now it's it, it goes, you know, if this was A, B, let's just make sure, C, D, E, your history would look like A, B, C, D, E instead of A, B, E. And so now that you've rebased, it's up here in the front. And if another commit's added, if you were to rebase again, it would actually cause the same conflict that you once resolved to happen again. And you see this all the time. It's all the time. In fact, everyone falls into this category here. Let me try to get this. There you go. This should work. So my first one is, I said, I'm convinced most people don't like rebase because they don't know how to use it and use it incorrectly. Become confused. I meant to say lose some work, skill issue, and then curse it. And then this Dan fella goes, no, I just like merging to multiple branches independently without resolving conflicts every 15 files for every PR, referring to that exact problem I was talking about. And I responded with, if only there was a way to reuse recorded resolutions to prevent a merge conflict. The joke there is reuse recorded resolutions is a very specific Git feature called re-re-re that people don't realize that fixes this exact problem. And so they don't even, I know it sounds okay. It's one of the lesser known features, but back to this thing. So if you were to enable re-re-re and you resolve this conflict, the next time you do this, and if you don't know how rebase works, remember, rebase takes your two commits right here and then plays them on top of right here. It plays them one at a time. So if you had a conflict right here, it's going to conflict every single time it plays. Well, what re-re-re does is that once you've resolved a conflict, say B and D conflict, it's going to say, okay, when I get to BD conflict, replay it just like this. And so it does it for you automatically. And so that's why, you know, that's why this tweet perfectly sums it up, which is, I don't think people realize that they have tools to make it easier because they keep going, wow, I keep getting the same conflict. This is just the worst. Why would you ever use rebase? And then it turns out actually you use rebase because it's really, really convenient.
The first time I dipped my toe into rebase because I had a coworker, they're like, whoa, you're not rebasing? Like, what the hell's wrong with you? And I was pretty new, maybe 2 years into development. And I'm like, I don't know, I just merge. And my first experience with rebase was like tons of conflicts, super annoying, and tons of forced pushing, which also is like annoying and scary. Now my workflow is better. You have to like change your workflow a little bit to like work with rebase. You have to think about rebase, know that you're rebasing. The way I think about it is, so like the advantage of rebase is this really nice linear history. And reverting's nice, but as we talked about, like neither you or I have really reverted a ton. To me, it's more about like just looking at that commit history, like seeing that nice history without all of the messy merge commits. Like it's just easier to see what's been happening in the repo. That's probably my favorite thing about rebasing.
Yeah. It does make things easier to look at if you're used to it. It does make things just, if you're a history peruser, which again, that usually points to someone who's worked in larger legacy apps, is that they've had to deal with history more. Typically, you know, you want to like kind of look through what has changed, how it's changed and all that. And linear history tends to just be easier. If you like open up your graph and it's just like a spider web of different branches, it can sometimes be a little bit emotionally confusing.
Myself included, just on GitHub, just like look at the past, you know, 10 commits or whatever. And like, it's going to show it linear, whether or not it is right. Like it puts all of the commits in an order
until a merge commit. No. Cause once you had a merge commit, you're going to have a parent with two different links and you're going to choose which link you're going
down. It shows the linear history, even if it's not, like it shows it visually that way, which can be confusing because it's not actually linear like that. Right.
Yeah. And again, it also is that, just the GitHub thing. I didn't even really think about this, but this is another excellent example. If you always do that, if you use GitHub to walk back a few commits, you'll never just reach that fork in the road where you have to choose which side do you want to go on and are you wrong or right?
The thing that people criticize rebase for is that you're rewriting history. And I'm going to paraphrase Sarah Bad Cop, shout out Bad Cop, as it's bad to rewrite history where it's bad to rewrite everyone's reality. You don't want to rewrite everyone's reality. We need to agree on what reality was. But in my branches, like, I own reality. I decide what reality. I am the god of my own branches. I think that's a really good way to think about rebasing.
Yes, I think that's fair. Yeah, the whole rewriting history thing, I mean, you could technically rewrite history with Git Reset as well. Git Reset and a force push. So does that make you should not use reset either? Well, no, that's probably not. That's not really fair. You wouldn't do that. I think, again, it's because somebody used rebase wrong. Therefore, everyone's like, rebase is terrible. And they didn't, it's just used it bad.
To be fair, it's easy to use wrong. But once you understand it, it's not.
It's easier to use wrong for sure. It's not like C, where C is just hard to use right. It's rebase is more like it's easy to use wrong at first, but then it's easy to use it right. Whereas C is just like it's hard to use it right to begin with, and it's harder to use it right as you go on because you write more sophisticated things. It only just gets harder. C is the only language that as you use it, it just gets like progressively creep up harder. On
you. It's like there's a couple things you just need to do to use rebase safely. And as long as you do them, like you're okay for the most part.
It's no different than like learning how to program JavaScript. When you pass an object around, you have to make the trusted assumption people aren't going to go mucking around with things. And at one point, if you used JavaScript, say 15 years ago, that was not the case. For all of us who remember those IE7 days, programming in the Wild West, just editing things everywhere, like those were different days. And that was a reality that any library could just mutate your object at any point, and you had no idea what was happening. And so it's like, we've come to some like, you know, I'm not sure what the proper term is, gentleman agreements, Marquis of Queensberry rules of programming. But it's just like, hey, don't edit my object. Deal. Right. And it's the same thing with rebase. Just, hey, don't edit this object. Don't screw this
libraries
up.
Libraries
right?
had these crazy names for things specifically so that like their namespace wouldn't get mutated. Right. I remember that.
I do remember those days.
I was just coming out of the scene at the tail end of that. But like all of the, I mean, you'll still find code like that, but. It was very much around. Okay, so now I want to shift gears just a little bit and talk about what you've been doing in the terminal. As many people listening to this podcast will know, you recently sold out of terminal.shop coffee. What?
Yep, 36 hours and we sold out, unfortunately. It's fortunate, too, because I think that it nil blend, our first blend, will be known as our worst blend, which is a good thing. Because I think we'll only ever get better. We got new roasters. I really pushed to help find some new. I pushed to get Dax to find new roasters. I didn't do anything. Okay. I'm like the model. Okay. Yeah, I really cracked the whip. I really made it a priority because I think it'd be the best. And I think everyone kind of agreed that even though it's a good blend. It's definitely a different blend. It has a little bit more green flavor to it. It's not what I would want as the identity of it. And so we're finding and found better stuff or different stuff. Or shall I say different rather than better? Some people really like the green taste. Some people just hate it. And so it's like, you know, we're finding all these things. And so running a coffee company is really difficult. And there's a lot of edges. I think Dax talked about it on the Tomorrow podcast with Adam. I don't know if you saw that clip going around, but he talked about how there is like this boutique, not a boutique. There is this influencer coffee brand that just is around. You slap your label on it, they white label it for you, and bada bing, bada boom, you are now a coffee distributor, and everybody's doing it, right? The thing is we didn't do that. We found our own. We sourced it. We got it from Brazil. We went the whole nine yards. We're trying to really figure out all the right things, and now it comes down to like roasting. Like, who's our roasters? How are they roasting it? Who's going to be doing the shipping? How are we going to ship this well? How are we going to provide correct packaging? Who's producing the package? How many packages should we buy ahead of time? Right, like, so we're doing like the whole nine yards. We're not doing some simple thing. And the big kicker, which I thought was the best, is that I wanted it to be different, and it was actually TJ and I that originally came up with this concept, but we kept laughing about like, what can you build in NeoVim? That's just ridiculous. And so we kept like, what is the most absurd thing? And then it came down to like, what happened if you could buy coffee from NeoVim? And luckily our friend Bash was a part of this whole thing and she's been working at Charm. And so all of a sudden it just kind of like dawned, like TJ and I were talking and it dawned on us at the same time. What if you could order coffee from SSH? Wouldn't that be like the coolest thing ever? And you know, you got to realize your audience. Like, you don't make boot.dev for the person who doesn't want to program. You made boot.dev for the person who wants to program. I don't know what people who don't program think about coffee. I know what people who program think about coffee, which is that's the direct translation from coffee to code. It's like one of the most important aspects of life. And it's not, you know, there are some boutique coffee drinkers, but there are just a bunch of people who want pretty decently good coffee at a decent enough price that's convenient. And it's just like, what better way can we do to really like lean into this SSH thing? And so our goal is to get, you know, subscriptions, that better roaster coming online, more stuff, really lean into the memes. We have a lot of really cool, I wish I could even talk about the cool ideas we have. I can't talk about any of them, but like, that's the whole concept, which is like, let's make a brand for developers by developers. Let's not even think about this from an outside perspective, because no one in their right mind would have made a company in which the way you order is via SSH.
I don't think anyone saw it coming.
We did it.
I was going to guess that it was Dax's idea. So it wasn't Dax's idea.
No, it was TJ and I were like the originators of, I mean, Dax could have been in the conversation too, to be completely fair. Dax and Adam could have been in the conversation. But TJ and I have been talking about this for like a year of just like, what's the dumbest thing we can do with NeoVim and the things we can build. And, you know, I'm always asking him questions about, oh, we could do this. Or what would happen if we did this, you know? And he's just, him and I tend to, when we get into a session of thinking about things, it just tends to get way too wild. And so it just accidentally got there. And then once we set it, it was like Pandora's box was open. And I was like, that will get to the top of Hacker News.
I saw it organically. I didn't even see the tweet.
Guess what happened? It got to the top of Hacker News, and I didn't post that. Yeah. I don't know. I don't even know who Ethan Holt is.
No, I stumbled across this organically, and then later,
none of us posted it. None of us tried to get someone to post it.
It did well on Hacker News too, like super well.
Yeah, because again, I think that's we're trying to do something different, which is we're trying to create something that is good, like that is as ethical as we can make it, as fairly priced as we can make it. We're small, so obviously we don't have nearly the efficiencies of Starbucks. And Starbucks, by the way, it's not like Starbucks is that good of coffee. If you buy Starbucks and you do like a pour over yourself, you get none of like the foam at the top. Usually that's like an indicator of how fresh the beans are and all that. It's like nothing at the top. It's not necessarily that great. And it's like $23 a bag, $24 a bag. And so it's like, we're trying to compete against that, because that's a lot of times what people, you know, look at a price of and say, oh, well, what about that? And she was like, okay, well, we got to get our price. We effectively have to be on par with them. But if we can offer significantly better, then people will change their habits. And so our goal is really just to focus on the goodness of it. And then then if we can, lower the price if we can. So that's kind of like our general business strategy. But, you know, it's hard, because what happened if we want to do really cool things? We have I can't tell you what it is, but I'll just tell you this. We have ideas of how to make very memeable and viral ideas surrounding coffee, and those are also just generally more expensive, because whenever you do limited of anything, you're getting a printer who's going to be printing custom bags. You're going to have the custom short amount of bags sent to your packing thing. You have to have the packing people. They have to be aligned. They have to know exactly what they're going to be packing, these specific ones. Like, you know, like we have to, there's like all these stages you have to come up with that are just like,
so
more complicated.
I have this question. Adam doesn't drink coffee and he doesn't stream anymore. Why did you hire him? Or why did you partner with him?
You know, Adam, can I be real for a second? He's a really good guy.
Okay.
And he's business
savvy.
I mean,
he is the only one of the four of you that started a successful company, I think.
I think Dax has also done it too.
I don't know. We'll have to fact check that one. We'll have to fact check
Dax. I can't remember if Dax has or not. Yeah,
he likes to shit on people for not starting successful companies, but I'm not sure he's started one yet.
SST is an invested company.
But he's not a founder.
I know. I don't know.
He joined later.
I know.
Right? I mean, he'd probably count it, but I don't know if I'd count it. I'm pretty sure he came on like a year later, because he was a user of SST, I think, is the story. He told the story on the pod.
Mm.
So I don't.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. See, I don't know. I don't know his original story. But Dax is obviously he's a very great finisher and business guy. Dax's wife is even better. She's actually helped quite a bit. I mean, she might need a little bit of equity out here. Let's see. TJ and I are, you know, I think I'm considered the influencer, which is so funny.
I mean, obviously, I like, we all
that. It's absolutely ridiculous. Hey, I helped build the first version of the product, okay? That was such a W.
Speaking of, it's Mullet Stack, right? Go on the front end, TypeScript on the back end?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't choose that. So SST, the deployment and stuff is all in JavaScript. And then the front end is all in Go. So it's definitely the Mullet Stack. It's by far the strangest stack that has ever been created. I'm pretty sure we're the only one that is Go on the front end and JavaScript on the back end.
Very strange choice. Very strange choice. You usually at least just go full stack, but I understand that you've got to use SST. Cool.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about, I just want to kind of wrap all this up with, tell me a little bit about the stuff you've been doing with all the rendering engine stuff in the terminal. So you did some rendering with the coffee company with Terminal HQ or terminal.shop, and you're doing Doom in the terminal with ASCII art. What are you working on?
For me, I really love this idea of real-time games. I worked on a little bit at Netflix. I thought it was super, just a very compelling kind of concept. I get very excited about it. And so there's just so much work to get it even remotely close to being any usable at all. So I'm trying to like shortcut every possible step to make it so that I can get something going. And so right now, like we could technically play a game of Minesweeper, like right now.
Do I have to SSH somewhere?
Where you can type in my Twitch chat. No, you can just type in my Twitch chat and it will actually direct the cursor around and it'll be running off my computer. So here's my general idea. First, this is so ridiculous. I'm going to give you my plan. Okay. Are you ready for this? All right. So this is my plan is that I'm going to have my computer. I know this is a great, I'm a great drawer, by the way. Here's my computer, System 76, still waiting on that sponsorship. I'm then going to have probably Fly.io or something like that. Where I may have one or two or three, who knows how many flies I'll have. I'll have a few of them up there. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to render out a game. So I don't want to say Doom particularly, just a game. But right now, Doom is the focus. I'm going to render out this game, specifically in ASCII. I'm then going to send up this feed to these computers from my computer. Just because, again, I just don't want to increase complexity and actually start figuring out how to launch games over here. I don't want to have to create like a game session manager and a game instant manager and all that kind of stuff. So right now, I'm keeping it simple. I hand artisanally launch a game here and send up all of its data to these like instances. And then people on Twitch with their eyeballs, right, or whatever Twitch's logo is, I'm close to it. Effectively, their eyeballs can then open up a browser, which will get this streamed in and will render the ASCII art in the browser right here. And so the goal is that I'm going to play a game of Doom. And by I mean I'm going to start a game of Doom. Twitch chat is going to provide me a stream of W's, A's, S's, D's, fires, all of that stuff. And it's going to, and they're going to be able to look at it real time. Because remember, Twitch is like 5 to 10 second lag time. So you can't play it there. So this is going to probably be closer to like maybe 500 millisecond lag time. So much more possible to get people to play there. Maybe if you're very close, it could be 200. Maybe if you're in India, maybe it's 1 second. But still, much, much more accomplishable as far as speed goes here. So very, very excited about this proposition or this idea.
This is Twitch and plays so Pokemon, but not
the idea here or
laggy. Or less laggy, I should say. Yeah.
Not laggy. That's the goal, is that you view it off of Twitch, but the final result is on Twitch with everyone typing. There's so many fun problems here. Like one of the biggest problems, and I think I can even show it right here. Let me just zoom in a kajillion fold. There we go. I'm going to go over one project. I'm going to go right here, and I'm going to run this. Oopsies. Here we go. I broke something. Don't worry about it. But this right here is me experimenting with different types of compiling. So right now, every single frame is 13,992 bytes of characters and 13,992 bytes of colors.
13K.
So that's effectively 28K per frame every single time.
Really? The color and the number of characters
so that means if
about
I were to,
the same amount of data?
Well, yeah, because it's ASCII. So every single character is placed everywhere on the screen and every single character
one
comes with a color as well.
1 byte for the color.
1 byte for the color because it's 8-bit coloring. I know. Absurd, right? Anyways, so I have this whole thing going on right here. And so I'm like, okay, I got to make it smaller. So the first thing I'm trying to do, the reason why do I have to make it smaller? Why can't I just gzip it, right? Because that's like your first probably question is, why not just gzip it? Well, unfortunately, if you do not know anything about WebSockets, there's a standard, there's a WebSocket extension, RFC 67 something, 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 that is per message deflate, which allows you to have encoding or per message something. I thought it was per message deflate, but I might be slightly wrong on its name. But it allows you to have gzip on both sides. So you get a really small image. Well, guess what? It's not implemented in browsers.
Wait, why are we using a browser? This is ASCII.
Yes.
I feel like this is...
Oh, because I want to implement it in a browser. I want to implement it in a browser. I want to implement it here because the problem is if I use SSH, a lot of these SSH protocols, I have to send everything down, right? I don't know how efficient these SSHs are. I don't think they're not going to be as efficient as I'm probably going to be able to make it. So my first attempt is to make RLE, which stands for run line encoding. Run line encoding is super ultra duper simple. All it does is, let's say you have the character string W, 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 D, W, 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 W. You could probably naively see the encoding right away. 4W, 1D, okay. 4W.
Put the number before the repeated letter.
Right. Yeah. One byte to how many times it repeats, one byte to the character you're repeating. Very, very simple. And simply doing that has led to color being 40% of the size and chars being 60%
so
of the size.
Your ASCII art, does it... So I'm guessing certain characters come up a lot more than others.
So this is where we're going to get into level two that I'm really going to think about. So I'm going to quickly jump back here and I'm going to play a little bit of... Even though you won't be able to see a whole bunch of it, I'm going to play a little bit of Doom right here. So you can kind of see it on your split screen. But you'll notice a couple things about this. Here, let's actually quit this for a second. Let me relaunch it. Quit it right here. One thing I noticed right away is that every single character is duplicated because they needed to make a square-ish pixel. So everything is duplicated. So the first thing I'm going to do is make a Doom-specific encoding that knows that every single byte is actually duplicated. Every single color is duplicated. Yeah, so that's like, boom, I immediately cut it to 50% right off the rip.
Specific encoding.
So that's a good thing to know. Yeah. And then what I realize is that if we do RLE, RLE is going to have a whole bunch, especially there's like a few things. There's a lot of things happening here that might be confusing to the average person looking. But one thing that RLE will do, if I cut these all in half, RLE may not perform very well. So I'm going to have to start checking, do I successfully actually encode things well or bad? So I'm going to have to like turn it on and turn it off and drop it. Taking the diff between two buffs, does that turn it on or turn it off, right? So I'm going to have to do like a bunch of, and diff is XOR, by the way. So you just like flip the bits and see what has changed. And if nothing's changed, it produces a bunch of zeros. And so it's like, okay, so I can actually turn it on and off for that. But if you look at this, like just you looking at this, can you tell me an observation, say, at least about the colors and potentially even about the letters?
I mean, I don't know exactly what you're going for, but like there's big blotches. There's obviously big blotches, like for example, red.
Yes. And so if I were to do run line encoding, I'm going like this.
The patterns are going across.
Whereas they tend to be in blocks, right? So like blue, you know, there's a lot of blue and black right in here. There's a lot of repeat characters right in here. So what if instead I did what is referred to as a quad tree? So I break this into four sections and then did another quad tree, break it into four sections, and then runtime encoding that small box right here, or for this side, it'd be like this small box right here. Just do like a small runtime encoding right here.
Yeah, because that whole red section could apply,
you know, so that could
two bytes or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So it could actually work out well. We don't know yet, but I'm liking where this is going. It is very, very exciting to me that this is possible. And then on top of it, there's another thing called Huffman encoding, which I want to try, which Huffman encoding is effectively all you do is you count every single type of character you want to encode. So you create a big list and then you add them all to a priority queue. And when you add them all to a priority queue, you then take that and you find like the minimal encoding. And so some characters will have really bad encoding that are the least frequently occurring ones. And then the ones that are very highly occurring will have really good encoding. So a good encoded character could have, say, 4 bits. So it's like you could pack those really tightly, and a bad one could have 9 bits, but maybe only 5% of them are bad bits and 50% of them are good ones. So it's like you could really pack things really tightly, and I can execute that on both sides of the WebSocket. I could write the decoder in JavaScript and I can write the encoder in Go. So it's like very, very possible to potentially get these messages down to like 20%, 10%. Like I'd ideally like to try to get it below 10% the original size. Just so we can, just because if I have, say, 2,000 people watching a stream, every minute I could be transferring 50 megabytes per person. Well, okay, if I can get it down to 10%, that's only 5 megabytes per person, which is, you know, at 1,000 people, that's like 5 gigabytes in a minute. So it's like, okay, bytes matter at this point. How can I make it as like
so
tiny
I have a question,
as possible?
Because we've been talking about...
So there you go. That's my thing. I'm building encodings and stuff like that.
We've been talking about encoding and compression, which obviously like reduces the amount of bytes per frame in the video. Is bandwidth the problem, I guess, is my question. Is this all to get the response time down like below 1 second, 500 milliseconds? Like, does the bandwidth affect the latency that much, I guess is my question, or is it more one about cost, like the bandwidth that you're paying for on your server? Okay.
It's going to be about cost for me, just because if I run one of these games for, say, 2 minutes and I end up transferring out 50 gigabytes, I'm going to use a pretty large chunk of like your cheap internet allowance from that for a full month, and I did it in like 2 minutes. So it's like, okay, so if I want to make this where we can actually beat the game, then that's a real, that's like, that's going to take some engineering effort to really reduce the size of this message, such that instead of sending out 50, I'm only sending out, say, one gigabyte in this minute. And that 1 gigabyte allows me to go for, you know, I can do 1,000 minutes then of Doom, or 1,000 minutes of whatever game I'm making. And it's like just way cheaper. And so it just seems like a much, probably.
So the game already feels fast and responsive to play. It's just with 1,000 people, you don't want to pay a ton of money in cloud bills.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'm now a full-time content creator. So accidentally getting $1,000 bill is just like, it's not necessarily.
Yeah. You can't
the thing I want to do. My wife would be way less impressed. I can't expense it to anybody. It's not like, oh, Netflix, help. And then the last thing that's going to be really fun is configuring out controls. I haven't really talked to a lot of people about my ideas for the controls, but I think this is like the funnest part, which is how do you get Twitch to play a video game? And so my general idea is the following, which is that I'm going to take the string of characters. Let's just say we have everyone's characters coming in, right? And they're all pressing these characters, you know, and they start changing, right? Maybe at one point they're trying to go forward, but then they realize they need to start turning. And so what I was going to start doing is sampling it every 16 milliseconds or some amount of time, whatever this interval is, and whatever was the most occurring character I played off, and I keep playing them as fast as possible. So the string of characters gets really, really tight to what's happening. So it tries to respond as quickly as possible to what the majority of people are saying.
So you're going to debounce it down to like, okay, we're only going to take one action every, 100 milliseconds.
Yeah, maybe it'll be one action every 100 milliseconds, but then every 16 milliseconds, I might feed that one action over and over again.
Yeah, like you're spamming
it. Like it's a key repeat, right? Because, you know, like you're actually holding down the key.
So you know about like Twitch Plays Pokemon, right? That was, I don't know, almost a decade ago.
I don't know what Twitch Plays Pokemon is, but so, I think
Twitch,
I get the concept.
Platform did like a marketing stunt. I don't know how many years it's been, but yeah, it was called Twitch Plays Pokemon, and like the chat played Pokemon. But my understanding was it was like this novelty thing, and it didn't really work at all because of the problems that you're talking about. Like everyone's spamming keys. It kind of just took one at random because in Pokemon, it's like, you can only move one square, I don't know, once every maybe 250 milliseconds. Like you can't actually move that much. So people are typing 50 characters in chat during that time. So it felt really random. And this could actually work, which would be really fun to see.
I think this would be a lot more exciting because everybody will be able to view the game in much nearer real time. We will be within a second of each other as opposed to 5, 10. I mean, there's some people that are reporting like 15-second latency between me and Twitch. And so that's a big latency for somebody trying to play a first-person shooter.
Well, yeah, it's unusable.
Because you're pressing fire 6 seconds before you're seeing what fire does. So that's the idea, is that if I can bring that latency way down, because to me, a lot of the backbones are going to be like 50 milliseconds. And so it's like, okay, I will be able to hit a backbone pretty quickly and be flying out there. And so if anyone else, especially if you're in America and you're near-ish, like you could be seeing what I'm seeing in like 100 milliseconds.
Is like, that's great. 500 milliseconds is like doable. I've played some Dota 2 with a full second of lag. It's hard, but you can kind of do it.
Yeah.
Anything over a second's pretty rough.
Anything over a second's pretty rough, but luckily there's no other players. You're just playing zombies. And so plus you're playing with the IQ of Twitch chat, which it's really weird. Twitch chat's really weird. They're very good at Minesweeper.
Huh.
They're very good at Minesweeper.
Why? Why are they good at Minesweeper and not Doom?
Minesweeper is inherently, due to the rate of actions, is inherently easier. So what I do is after an action, I pause the game for 7 seconds, and then I give 12 seconds to make the next move. Yeah, and it also gives them, you know, they make their move, and then usually a lot of people's lag allows them to see that the thing has changed. And then when they see that the board's different, then they're able to start voting before they even know the cursor's back on the map.
Well, I'm excited to see it. So final plugs.
Thank you.
Terminal.shop for all your coffee needs. It was sold out at time of recording. Who knows? There might be some coffee. SSH terminal.shop, right?
In a couple weeks from this recording, we're hoping to
Cool.
be back up and things running.
So that's for your coffee needs. If you're interested in the Git course that we talked about, boot.dev, promo code Prime for 25% off your first payment.
Yep. Or just boot.dev/Prime. The easier way to go. Boot.dev/Prime.
It's all the same. Thanks for coming on again, man. This is fun. Rebase your stuff. Yeah, keep rebasing.
Appreciate you, Lane. I'm rebasing hard right now.